You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, we are in Saint-Laury, Soulan, Pla, Dadé.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And we're in the press room at the summit of Pla Dadé, a big marquee. The noise is the wooden floorboards that have been laid for the press here. Rows and rows of people sitting watching. A lot of screens set up at the front showing the riders as they begin the climb of Pla Dadé. We're actually looking at Lisa Bardet there, who doesn't show all that much interest in the fact that her brother has just attacked on the descent and gained about 30 seconds, quite an audacious move by him. Daniel, what can we expect on this final climb? We're watching it.
Can we go outside and watch the race?
Yeah, let's go and watch the race, but let's just explain where we are. This is our second live podcast, and there's a breakaway with Rodriguez, Nicholas Roach, Rafael Maika in it, among others, and the chasers are a very diminished sort of main group. Lionel, take up as we walk outside.
Okay, well, we're not far from the finish line, so it's very warm in our press tent, isn't it? And it's quite chilly outside. We're just spotting Ciro, hard at work, deep in conversation.
Yeah, do you want to say hello on the podcast?
We've interrupted his conversation.
Sorry, Ciro.
My friends,
a live podcast, Ciro.
Nice to be here as usual.
And so, where are you going to watch? Are you going to watch finish at the finish line?
Or? For sure.
For sure. Do we head there now?
For sure, because the Grand Tours are of 3 weeks, but for me, the last week is the best one. And so I'm really motivated because for me, Paris from Pyrenees is really not far. This is my motivation,
we're
Lionel.
Can I just ask,
Ciro, you've got a t-shirt that says Aussie, 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 yeah. Oi, oi, oi on it. Is that in honour of Mick Rogers yesterday?
No, not at all. It's in honour of a friend of mine who took me this gift from Australia. I mean, I'm not really a supporter of Michael Rogers, I must confess. So there are no links between these two facts.
Okay, let's head down to the finish line.
See you later.
You heard some commentary there. You can still probably hear it now from Daniel Monjas, the voice of the tour. We're standing just beyond the finish line in the Espace Press, where the riders are coming past now. Rafael Maika has just won his second stage. And from an overall point of view, Vincenzo Nibali got away. The limpet, Jean-Christophe Perrault, stuck to his wheel. And it didn't quite turn out how the young Frenchman would have wanted it today, did it?
No, a little bit harsh to call Perrault the limpet, because he did make a few efforts to try and get clear of Nibali, but...
Did he make efforts to try and get clear of Nibali, or did he just help Nibali a little bit, which I find a bit odd, because all he had to do was sit on Nibali. Unless he's trying to win the Tour, of course.
Well, unless he's trying to move up to second overall. One of the big casualties today, Alessandro Valverde, lost ground. Be interesting to see where he comes over the line. He should be here any second now, really, but it looks like he's losing a minute and a half, I'd have thought. Got distance quite early on the final climb up to Pla Dadé there.
But Perrault looks like the second best climber in this year's race, behind Nibali. He's the guy that's been able to stick with him. It was interesting, Alessandro De Marchi there just being pushed past us. He was an ally, I think, to Nibali a little bit when Nibali caught up. He'd been in the big breakaway, and when Nibali with Perrault caught De Marchi, De Marchi went to the front. They'll know each other well, of course, and we were surrounded there by three members of the Cannondale team staff who kind of exchanged knowing looks and laughed at seeing that, but I think there was a bit of a favour done there.
Well, yeah, Daniel was saying when he was stood here with us, he's gone off to go and talk to some people, I think, but Daniel was saying the teams are kind of friends. They will look out for each other when they need to. But it's interesting there, Thibaut Pinot remains in a podium position at the moment, third overall, but Jean-Christophe Perrault has moved right up onto his shoulder now, only a few seconds behind, and only 30 or 40 seconds behind Alessandro Valverde, who stays in second place. But with the time trial still to come, that's I think second place still up for grabs.
Very much so. And another big day in the mountains tomorrow to Otakam, where you would maybe expect Valverde to lose a bit more time. So it's all to play for in terms of the podium. But Perrault finishing possibly second overall, that's a real possibility given his time-trying prowess. That's perhaps not the result that the French have been willing. There's been so much hype and expectation around the two young Frenchmen, Bardet, who had a good go on the descent before the final climb up to Pla d'Adet, and of course Thibaut Pinot.
In a funny way, that might take the heat out of things for Bardet and Pinot over the second half of the season and the winter, when expectation will ramp up for them. But if Perrault finishes ahead of them or makes it onto the podium, becomes the first Frenchman on the podium since Napoleon, I think.
Did Napoleon ever finish on the podium at the Tour?
Not sure. A very short rider, wasn't
he? We'll check that. It'll be on Wikipedia.
It will by the time I've finished recording this, yeah. But yeah, Perrault, in a funny way, might be doing a sort of medium-term service for Pinot and Bardet in that sense. I mean, Bardet and Perrault looked much more like they were working in tandem today. Bardet made that move on the descent of Val Laurent and really stretched things out and set things up for Perrault to be a little bit aggressive. And you're right, Rich, what you say about him, he could have just sat on Nibali, but I think it shows a bit of a bit of ambition at the tail end of his career. I mean, he's 37, he's not going to be going on for too much longer. This is his chance to secure the best possible result he can, and if that's second, that would be absolutely extraordinary for him.
Yeah, I mean, Gilles Simon, the head of cycling at L'Equipe, who we interviewed in our last As Live podcast, he made the point that to finish as high as second might not actually do Pinot or Bardet much of a favour in the long run. I think there'll already be a lot of expectation hype around them, but we can just see L'Equipe every day. I think he's torn between really getting behind them and giving them the backing, the support, trying to capture the French people's imagination with these young guys, but at the same time exercising a little bit of caution, not putting too much pressure on them. There will be huge pressure on them, I think, next year after what we've seen this year. Well, it's getting quite noisy here, Lionel. Will we head off to the buses and do some interviews?
Yeah, we will. Just a quick word on Micah, the stage winner, because that's now the third stage win for Tinkoff Saxo since their tour kind of fell apart when Alberto Contador was ruled out by that crash in the Vosges. Micah's won two. He's now extended his lead in the King of the Mountains competition. Joachim Rodriguez, who looked like he was going to try and challenge Micah for that jersey, he really he fell away on the climb to Pla d'Adet. So Micah's in the driving seat for that as well. And just from the minute and a half I spoke to Oleg Tinkoff yesterday, I get the feeling that they'll be really happy with how they've salvaged something from this Tour de France. Three stage wins, possibly the polka dot jersey. It was good to see the way Nicholas Roach as well. He worked very well, again, in tandem with Micah, trying to set something up. They both looked like they had opportunities. And
there's
just the
Bjarne
way...
Riis there, and Oleg, walking there's, right past us.
hugs all around again.
Yeah. It makes you wonder what might have been with Contador in the race, of course. The funny thing is, and we'll talk about this later, I think, with Daniel, I couldn't see Perrault finishing with Contador or Froome. I just couldn't see that at all. And it maybe does put Nibali's performance, as dominant as it had looked, has looked, into some kind of perspective. Let's leave it there, shall we, Lionel?
Sure.
And go to the buses.
Okay.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Fribb.
We're back at the press room now, chaps. Daniel has rejoined us. He was off and speaking to the French riders, and Lionel's here as well. And we've all been to do a few post-stage interviews. Raphael Micah was the stage winner, of course. A tremendous second stage win for him. And I was speaking to Andrew McQuaid, the agent, rider's agent at the finish, and he had an interesting theory about Micah that this first week of the tour, he really did nothing at all. In fact, he lost a lot of time. And he was a sort of reluctant conscript to the team, we thought, having also ridden the Giro. But perhaps just taking it easy a little bit in the first week means that he's, getting a bit stronger as the race goes on. Matt Bowden, you've joined us. Matt Bowden from Velo News.
Well, I was just walking on by.
Had a successful day, Matt?
It depends on how we define success, but it was a bit of a...
Cool, I think it was sun, haven't you?
I don't know, have I?
Well, that's a successful day right there.
I think it was a weird day. I was trying to report on the allegedly racist comments this morning.
Oh, well, we were going to talk about that.
The story overnight was an allegation that Michael Albassini of the Orica Green Edge team had made a racist comment towards Kevin Racer of Europcar. What did you find out, and what's the kind of the upshot of that allegation, and has it been resolved?
Well, I definitely wouldn't say that I know more than anybody else. I think there was a number of us running around this morning trying to report that. I think that the upshot is that, well, it appears to have been put to bed, but of course that's the story that we're going to hear. Albassini did come out and talk to reporters. I wasn't there. Rupert Guinness and some others were there, so I did see what he said. He said it was a misunderstanding. The Peloton's an international field with many languages, and he would never say anything racist. However, that comes, you know, I don't know, maybe 18 hours after, yes, the finish in Luchon, where Bernadeau, the Europcar general manager, was very upset. He was defending his rider. He said that Albassini had made a racist comment while they were trying to establish a breakaway, and Reza had apparently not pulled through, and Albassini was quite hot around the collar about it. So Reza didn't address it today, just said he would move on. I asked some other people if racism was an issue in the Peloton, and I talked to Robbie Hunter this morning. He said, no, not an issue at all. I mean, of course, you're not gonna see anybody come out and say, yeah, they're not gonna put the Tour de France on blast this morning. But, you know, Andy Hood reminded me today of an issue in 2010 where Nairo Quintana and some of his other Colombian riders were racing the Tour de l'Avenir, and they said that the French riders there had been pretty pushy and had maybe said some borderline things.
Yeah, this is really interesting, because it strikes me cycling is a long way behind other sports in kind of having a diverse field of competitors. You look at soccer, rugby, the American sports. Cycling is overwhelmingly white, and it's an issue that really hasn't had to be addressed. I know Andy Hampston gave me an interview once where he talked about the emergence of the Colombian riders in the 80s, and that they came in for quite a lot of abuse, not necessarily just because of their darker skin, but because, you know, culturally they were different to the European riders, who completely dominated cycling at that time. And I wonder, particularly with Europcar, Daniel talked about this, Jean-René Bernadeau having this drive to try and make his team more diverse. I wonder whether this is going to become something that cycling is going to have to address in a much more mature way than perhaps it was addressed yesterday.
I was going to mention the Colombians who came through in the 80s, you know, and it's difficult to pinpoint exactly why, because the Americans also came in for a bit of prejudice just because they were newcomers. The Colombians were blamed for a lot of crashes. Again, they were climbers. They tend to be at the back of the bunch. They tended, therefore, to be involved in more crashes. But there was definitely some hostility towards them. It's difficult to know whether that was racism or just prejudice against incomers. But it's Jean-René Bernadeau, from quotes I saw today, is he still pretty angry about it, Daniel? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I would guess so. I mean, it's becoming a bit of a sort of hobby horse of his, this racial integration. That's it's something that he's going to target with his team over the next few years. And I imagine that he'll be very sort of keen to, well, obviously, to stamp down on any hint of anything like what was alleged to have happened yesterday. But, you know, you get the same in any community when there's not been much racial integration in the early stages. There probably will be a lot of prejudice, unfortunately, and that will probably be the case in the professional peloton.
Well, there must be a huge wealth of untapped talent out there. If you have a sport which is predominantly white, it stands to reason that there must be some very talented black and Asian athletes out there, and cycling certainly needs to set a very early precedent that racism is just not going to be tolerated in any shape or form. You know, bike racing can get pretty heated, it can hot under the collar, but there are certain comments that are just beyond the pale, and I think you know, it would be good if the sport, the peloton, really sort of united behind that message.
Absolutely. Matt, you look like you're needing to go and work, so thank you very much for joining us briefly.
Yes, thanks very much for having me.
We'll have you back on the next Velo News podcast at the weekend.
Splendid.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Right, well, back to today's stage then, and the victory for Rafał Majka. At the finish, I spoke briefly to Nicholas Roach, his Tinkoff Saxo teammate, and I think one of the things you watched the stage unfold on television, as we did in the press space there, squinting at the screen, trying to work out who's doing what their various motivations are, and With Tinkoff Saxo having won a couple of stages already, the assumption I made, I don't know about you two guys, was that they're going for another stage win. But then you talk to a rider in the heat of the moment after a stage and you get a completely different perspective on what they were trying to do. And in fact, Nicholas Roach explained that they were out looking for the King of the Mountains jersey and that his job on the early climbs was to get into that break. I mean, he made a slightly sarcastic comment aimed at my daft question that you'll hear in a minute, but he explained that they set out together and Roach's job was to mark Joaquim Rodriguez, who was Micah's big challenger for the King of the Mountains. And he made the point also that if Micah is going to fend off Vincenzo Nibali for the polka dot jersey, he had to win this stage today with the horse category climb at the end and the double points. And so, once again, watching on TV, come to one conclusion, speak to a rider and get a completely different picture of what their motivations were.
Let's hear from Nicholas Roach and then go straight into Rafał Majka himself, talking a little bit about the stage win. And then finally, a Tinkoff Saxo trilogy here. Finally, Oleg Tinkoff, the team boss, who comes out, as always, with some colourful comments about not wanting to dance on Sir Brailsford's grave at one point. So you hear from Nicholas Roach, Rafał Majka, and Oleg Tinkoff.
Yeah, it was a huge battle. I suppose also made the race exciting. Two of the top climbers in the world battling for the mountains jersey. I think this year I'm happy. It's actually some years you have some kind of breakaway riders who have the mountains jersey. This year has been a battle among the best climbers. I think it's Rodriguez being out of the GC and Rafa as well. It meant that we could have that battle as well. And I think it was an exciting stage. Well, it's unbelievable. Yesterday was exceptional. And today is unbelievable. Every day in the bus is like, oh, it'd be nice if we get another stage win. But we set out with a smile, and you know, it's never done in advance. So we would have won a couple more. You know, the way Rafa is riding now, you put him in the position where he can try and win, and he wins. It's incredible. I'm really really happy with really happy for Rafa. I was super emotional about Michael's win yesterday. You know, we roomed together for the last year, and we shared those good and bad moments, and it was superb.
Was the King of the Mountains jersey the target today, or was it going out to get another stage win? Because the pair of you you worked together very well in tandem on the final climb, and
we knew that the only way Rafał can secure the Mountains jersey was by winning the stage. As you know, it was a HC climb with double points. Even if he wasn't picking up all the points on the other mountains, the important one was the last one. So if I can say we were aiming for the stage, which is the most important, and hoping that the jersey was going to come with it as a bonus.
You know, what was your role in actually sort of, you know, being up there as well?
Well, first of all, trying to get the points off Purito in the first one, trying to get the points on the second one, and trying to close the gap on Kirienka to make sure he was going to get some points on the third one, and riding flat out on the last one for him to try and get across to Visconti, and then he did the hardest.
Three gates, I'm happy, I win the Alps, and now in Pyrenees. My team is working for me perfect, he's doing a lot of job for me. Nicolas Roche is pulled out of pressure before the last climb. This is, for me, is perfect, because when I want to do it a lot of tempo in the climb, I want to win the stage.
I'm still cannot determine is it good successful tour for us or not. Of course, to win free stage, it's exciting, and especially to win the best stages. But we lost Alberto, we lost Yellow Jersey. It's difficult to say if it's successful on the tour, most probably not. But I'm definitely proud of my team, and I'm excited because we come back, we show the world that in the tough times we are there, we come back and we fight, and we really fight. And I'm very, very excited, and I'm there's no words. I mean, to win such a beautiful stages, my first ever Tour de France as a team owner. Three stages, two in a row. Super.
Michael Rogers yesterday said that it's thanks to you and Bjarne Riis that they stood up.
I think me, Bjarne, it's very good combination. I think we have strong team, but of course, Bjarne has strong mentality, strong leadership. I brought a lot of things from the business. And Actually, my goal is modernized cycling. I know that Mr. Brailsford, Sir Brailsford, he did a lot. He changed cycling. I respect it a lot. But we want to go further. We want to build not only the best team in the world by the sport merits, but we want to build new, modern cycling team based on new technologies, if you wish, big data, technologies, best state-of-art nutrition and coaching programs. So that's my goal, to build a successful modern cycling team. And I think Bjarne's role there is a crucial, so mine as a businessman.
You mentioned Dave Brailsford there. Do you think you've shown Team Sky how you can still win stages when you've lost your leader?
Ah, definitely. Actually, I feel a little bit sorry about them because they're a strong team. What they have done for cycling is countless. They really changed the cycling, and chapeau. But this year, they don't do it so well. And actually, it's pity. I'm not really trying to dance on their grave. It's a bad season for them, but I hope they come back too. And I think next year we're going to have big fight. There is definitely two best team out there, Sky and us. And it's a pleasure for me to fight with Sir anyway, right? I'm Russian.
Yeah, one last question. Sorry, you said you'd celebrate the last stage win by Rafa with champagne. How will you celebrate tonight?
With magnum of champagne. With two champagnes.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we heard there from Nicholas Roach, Rafał Majka, the stage winner, and Oleg Tinkov, who said he's going to celebrate with a magnum of champagne tonight. We were all at the finish and saw, you know, the riders come in, you know, in various states of elation, despair and fatigue. I saw Paul Voss, the NetApp Enduro rider, who has been riding for the last couple of weeks with a broken nose and, more problematically, a broken finger, which means he can't really brake very well on the descents, and he's really struggling with that. Couldn't even get his rain sort of or wind jacket on at the top there. He's in a lot of pain with his finger, which is in a sort of splint, so he's struggling on. He says the broken nose isn't a problem, the broken finger is. Saw Michael Rogers come in as well, yesterday's stage winner, and he embraced Nicholas Roach. Didn't know who'd won the stage, which, you know, is interesting because we think that they're all wired up and they hear what's going on, but there was a warm embrace. And again, we saw today something that you see time and again, that when a team is winning, it's easier to win. You know, I think we saw it in the Giro with Orica Greenedge, when that stage that Peter Wiening won in particular. I think he won that because it didn't matter too much if he didn't win. There's that sort of confidence flows through the team. Lionel, you see anything at the finish?
Well, yeah, I'll talk about that in a little bit. We'll throw over to the French because they've had their battle today. Jean-Christophe Perrault has made a big step forward. Should just mention that our friend of the podcast, Daniel Lloyd, is sitting at home, probably dancing in his front room watching the Tour de France, because he put £10 bet on Perrault finishing in the podium positions back in April at 500-1. So the magnums of champagne will be on him if Perrault makes it onto the podium in Paris.
Dan Lloyd, a journalist now, of course, stands to make more money from this tour than any other journalist working at the tour. Probably more than all the other journalists working at the tour put together. He's not even here.
But what about the French, Daniel? Because at first glance, it looks like Perrault might be doing a bit of a favour to Pinot and Bardet in a way. If he is the top Frenchman, it takes a little bit of the heat out of their performance.
Yeah, it will do. An amazing performance from him today. As we know, recovery tends to be the thing that suffers with age, and he's 37 years old, turned pro 2010. But, you know, the one thing that his team and his team manager Vincent Lavenu keeps stressing is just what an incredible specimen he is as an athlete. His physiological numbers are very impressive. VO2 max around 86, 87. And, you know, the Vincent Lavenu said at the finish tonight that he regrets that he hadn't turned pro earlier because he thinks he would have won a Tour de France. I'm not sure, with the sort of climate that prevailed in those years, pre-2010, I think it would have been a mightily tall order. But, he just goes from strength to strength.
What did you think of the way they raced on the final climb? Because it looked like everybody was on the limit, really suffering. There were a lot of rocking and rolling shoulders, wasn't there? People were, you know, they were going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. It wasn't like anyone could really put one move in and make it stick.
No, I mean, it's such a difficult climb to Plat d'Adet. The road is quite wide, so it's maybe a little bit deceptive. You don't realise how steep it is until you actually go up it. And I think they were just on their knees. And, you know, that is the one worry about tomorrow's stage, that the racing perhaps won't be as aggressive as it has been the last 2 days, just because everyone's so tired. It's been very hot. Today was very very exposed as well on the final climb, not much shelter. Just going back to Perrault as well, one thing that another direct sportif from AG2R said tonight, Julien Jourdi, was that very early in his road career, so 2010, well, he was with Lotto initially, then he moved to AG2R, but like a lot of mountain bikers, he couldn't get used to and he couldn't adapt to the team dynamic. He said he just did his own thing, had no real sense of sort of camaraderie and how to manage his teammates, and he said that that's something he's only learned in the last year or so.
Has he learned it? Has it changed? I mean, the relationship between him and Bardet, what's it like? Do you know?
Very good, I think, and I think they played it perfectly again today. Bardet had his freedom to go on the descent. He was always going to be the outsider of the two for today, and so he went first. And then, you know, he did a perfect job sitting on Pino's wheel when Pino was behind Perrault then, and Perrault was up the road with Nibali. So I think, you know, they played that really well, and I think Bardet tomorrow will again have some freedom to maybe chance his arm early on the final climb to Hautacam.
It's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, we were talking about racism earlier, and we're maybe slightly ageist about Perrault, and I think emotionally it's difficult to connect with him in the same way as it is with Bardet and Pino, and to see him, you know, stuck to Nibali's back wheel and then helping him out a bit on the climb, it's surprising. And you know, I said to Lionel earlier, if we'd said at the start of this tour that Nibali would be finishing with Perrault on the climbs, you'd say, well, Nibali's not going to be the guy winning the tour then. That's the big shock. And I suppose there's that, you know, that we all love. We spoke to Cathy LeMond earlier, and we'll hear from her later in the programme, and she was talking about just how much Greg LeMond, her husband, is getting behind Pino because he's a young guy. He's encouraged by seeing 22, 23-year-old riders contend at the Tour just as he did, just as Laurent Fignon did, just as Bernardino did, just as the real greats have done. And, you know, and it's odd, and I think inevitably you have questions. They might be perfectly innocent questions, such as why is this guy emerged so late? As you explained, Daniel, there are very good reasons for that.
Yeah, and I mean, just it comes down to the style as well of the riders. I think, you know, Pino's a bit of a swashbuckler, very aggressive, so is Bardet. Perrault has been more crab-like at times in the past, and even throughout this tour until today. Today, he did take the initiative. You know, another thing Jourdi, one of his direct sportifs, was saying tonight was that, and this is something we hear in other sports as well, that he's real age is 37, but in kind of athletic years, he's a lot younger because for years he was doing much shorter races, training over much shorter distances because he was a mountain biker. So he hasn't got that sort of physiological wear and tear of riding for 6 and 7 hours every day.
One of the things that struck me about the way they raced today, not Perrault because he is at the other end of his career, but Pino and Bardet, if Contador and Froome had been in this race, there is no way they would have had the tactical kind of freedom to make decisions, to be part of the race in quite the way they are being part of the race at the moment. They would have been perhaps in the second group, limiting losses, riding on the wheels and just getting in as quickly as they possibly could, losing a little bit each time. I think we can't know now, but surely this stands them in good stead for the next years coming forward, that they are actually learning a bit of racecraft, which when you talk back to Laurent Fignon, think back to Laurent Fignon in 1983, that was one of the reasons he came to the fore, I think, because Bernardino was out of the race, there was this freedom to take the race by the scruff of the neck. And although neither Pino or Bardet are winning this race, they are getting a chance to actually properly race against one another, against the other riders, play their cards and actually learn from some of the mistakes they're making.
Yeah, and what's been really nice has been the selection has come from the front in this race rather than the back. You know, we've seen these big trains in the mountains that have you know, Sky and other teams before them, which have just set an impossible rhythm and people have just kind of fallen off the back. And you know, we see scenarios like yesterday, we talked about Jeremy Roy up the road, stopped, listened to the radio for 5 minutes. That's not a typical scenario, that's not happening every day, but you know, kind of real intricacies like that. Bardet today stretching out a little bit on the descent. You know, I spoke to Thibaut Pinot's brother Julien at the finish, and he said that Arnaud Janssen, who rode a blinder again, he came back on Plat d'Adet, but He probably would have had an even bigger role to play had he not been chasing after Bardet, who had attacked. So, you know, just things like that. And like you say, Lionel, they are real actors in the race. And you know, these things wouldn't be happening if there was one dominant team or two dominant teams.
I mean, Jansen, again, did a great job of really shepherding, marshalling Pino down the descent, looking after him there. I mean, one other thing, just returning to Perot, is this whole idea of older riders also doing well. We're seeing, you know, as people live longer, why shouldn't their athletic careers also be extended? We saw Chris Horner win the Tour of Spain, not seen much of him in the Tour this year, although I read some comments from him today that he thinks he can win the Tour of Spain again. We'll see about that. But, you know, there's Chris Horner, there's Jens Voitsel riding, there are three 40-year-olds in the race. And I don't, you know, I think there is no reason physically why somebody who's 37 can't contend at the Tour. It's purely mental. And as you say, Daniel, if someone comes to the sport late, they're perhaps a bit fresher in the head as well as the body.
And yet we've seen the opposite phenomenon in recent times as well. You look at the Giro d'Italia recently, was very significant for the emergence of a lot of young riders, actually dominated by riders under 25. And in this race even, you know, Bardet and Pino, they're remarkably young to be doing what they're doing. It's really since, you know, Jan Ulrich that someone has actually contended at the age of 23 for a Tour de France title. I think I'm right in saying.
Can I just also say, before we wrap up today's stage action, if this was a contest of 17 individual road races rather than a grand tour with the overall yellow jersey up for grabs, it's been a race of absolutely terrific stages. If you take the stages just in their isolation, the racing has been, it's been interesting, it's been varied, there's been some tactical nuance to it. You've seen teams working together to try and sort of help one another. I don't mean team, you know, rival teams working together, I mean riders within teams sort of slingshotting each other up the road and getting you know, using sort of tactical nous. And every day's racing, I think, has been it's been exciting, it's been interesting, it's been varied, and it's just the yellow jersey picture, which Nibali has dominated totally, which has kind of just given perhaps a false impression of the race that we're actually seeing.
I think today was another stage, very short stage today, 120 odd kilometres, and it was, you know, fat cack from the start. It was one of those stages where you're sort of lucky enough to be able to watch the whole thing. And a bit like 2011, that stage to Alpe d'Huez that was lit up by Alberto Contador. We saw very aggressive racing right from the start. And I think these short mountainous stages are some of the best and a great innovation by Christian Prudhomme.
Yeah, and just how, you know, it's incredibly nuanced, some of the racing, and it's coming down to such fine details, such fine fragments of the race. Like tomorrow, for instance, when they come off the Tourmalet, there's about 15 kilometres of kind of descending false flat before they get to the bottom of the horse camp, and that's going to be absolutely crucial. Those 15 kilometres, based on what we've seen so far, you know, like I talked about Bardet's attack on the descent today, how that had probably quite a big influence on the result. And you know, tomorrow I think that is going to be key. You'll see probably breaks go early, and I think Frances de Jure will put someone in a break specifically for those 15 kilometres, and you might see that with other teams as well.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, we're going to have to get off this mountain quite soon because they organise official evacuations, and we've got to find out when that's going to be and follow a train of fast moving vehicles down the wrong side of the road, which is always a bit of fun. Lionel, anything more from the summit today?
Well, yeah, sometimes when we have these summit finishes at quite tight places like Plaid Adet, they don't bring all the team buses up, and so you see a different side of the Tour de France where the gendarmes, the police officers, are standing in the area just past the finish line to try and give the riders a bit of protection from the hordes of media who are waiting there for their interviews. And I just stood by the giant Shimano Soigneur just to see Cheng come over the line, because he's last overall about 11 hours down, but looking at Paris, looking at becoming the first Chinese to complete the Tour de France, and just saw a little moment that highlighted to me the hierarchy and pecking order that exists in the Tour de France and in teams. Marcel Kittel came over the line. One of his teammates took his bike from him. Kittel sat down on a moped that presumably a member of the public's moped, and he just commandeered that as his own seat. His soigneur took his jersey off him and gave him a towel so he could dry off, and got him a fresh jersey. Kittel sort of drank his drink in one go, a can of Sprite in one go, and meanwhile Cheng was stood sort of changing himself and trying to take his shoes off and put a pair of trainers on, and he was toweling himself down, and then one of the Soigneurs bumped into him, and he's only a little guy, practically knocked him over. And there was just in this moment, you know, Cheng is battling to finish the Tour de France, probably in last place. Kittel is the sprint king. This is not a day for him, yet he still gets treated like the star he is, I suppose.
And Cheng had probably been towing him up every mountain, because that is the job he's been doing in recent days.
Yeah, he said today that the first mountain was okay, but then the next one was pretty bad, and then the third one was worse, and then he recovered a little bit, and then the fourth one was awful, and his legs were really painful. I mean, that's a fairly obvious and succinct breakdown of his day. But he finished in the gruppetto, I think. If not, he would only have just been a little way off the back. So it looks like he's going to make it, but he's not counting his chickens just yet. His chickens in Coca-Cola.
I was going to say, Lionel, brilliant, brilliant. He's as you'll know from a previous interview with Cheng on the podcast, he's a very keen cook, and his special dish is chicken wings and Coke. Now, we're just going to wrap this up, but finally today, as we arrived today at the top of the mountain, we bumped into the Le Mans, and there was a very nice reaction to Greg LeMond's arrival from local people fans who gathered around the car when they saw his face on the side of it, and you know, gave him a nice little round of applause as he emerged from the car. And we had a chat off to the side with Cathy LeMond, who, you know, was really... The Le Mans were always a double act at the Tour. She was around at the Tour in the 80s, which was very unusual at the time. She was a real sort of pioneer in that sense. And this is the first time, well, as she told us, the first time she's ever done a full Tour, but it's her first time back at the Tour for an extended period in over 25 years. So we had a quick chat with Cathy. She admits that she's a fan of the podcast, listens to it when she can't sleep. And here she is.
It's Cathy Le Mans. Here we are at the summit of Pla d'Adet. Gorgeous.
Yeah,
and you're back at the Tour for the... Oh, Daniel's here now.
This
as well.
This is perfect. We've got your whole group.
Yeah, we're all
the group. I listen to you guys at like 3 a.m. when I can't. If I can download it, if we have internet, I listen to your podcast.
But it's a great way of getting to sleep, isn't it?
It puts me to sleep. That's what I listen to it for. I'm sorry,
Cathy,
to say it that way.
But. First time back at the Tour since... When was your last time at the Tour?
No, we came last year for the 100th anniversary.
Right,
but not with Greg
race.
Working. Well, I've never done the whole race. My first Tour de France.
Wow.
Start to finish.
Are you enjoying it?
I'm loving it. I really love it.
Are you...
But I have this crazy love for the Tour de France. I don't know why. I mean, like, I come here and I just... It just meant so much to us that... Like, sometimes I feel like crying when I'm here because it was just so important.
And, you know, there'd be still a lot of people around who you'd have known in the 80s. Is anybody you've particularly enjoyed catching up with?
Everybody. I can't believe it. Everybody's here. All the old teammates. And now it's really funny because all the old Zed teammates are in high-up management at ASO. So, yeah. Le Marchand, Gouvenou, everybody. You know, they're going to run the Tour soon. And they were just... sweet, sweet teammates who now are really authorities in the sport.
And I mean, for a while, Greg and you kept away from the Tour for reasons that we know all about,
because
of Greg's relationship with Lance Armstrong.
It just hurt too much to come, and, you know, it just the love for real cycling is so profound, and to come and it not be authentic was just too painful.
But have you felt that this is... that the Tour has restored itself, has recovered from those years?
I'd say it's really turned around. I mean, when you see Thibaut Pinot or Bardet, you see 23 and 24-year-olds, oh, my God, it makes me so happy to see that. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I have not heard Greg yell in enthusiasm. And when Pinot... dropped Nibali at the top of the climb yesterday, even by those few feet we were in the motorhome, he's like, yes! He was so excited. I'm like, oh my God, this is great. It was really good.
What is it that Greg likes about Thibaut?
I think his age, he's aggressive. It's only his second Tour, I think.
Third, I think, isn't it?
Third? Okay. He just had him as a guest. We met his girlfriend. I don't know. He just seems, I don't know, like a fighter.
You use the word authentic as well. And I guess, is Greg reconnecting with some of the stars of the sport and finding them authentic, believable.
Oh, yeah. And also the wattage outputs on the climbs have been, I don't know what yesterday was, can't say that, but they're in the realm of possibility, whereas for so many years it wasn't even possible that it could be authentic. So
what's been a highlight for you so far then, Kathy?
Highlight?
The podcast?
Definitely. No, what's the highlight? I don't know. Eating lunch every day at the canteen for French TV. Every morning we wake up and think, okay, what are we getting today? It's that good.
How about the being reunited with Eno? How was that?
It's so funny. He's super friendly. I don't know why. He's like always
maybe he's
hanging
not seen
around.
The film.
I don't think he has. Like, it was, he's coming around every day to say hi, and just super, super friendly. It's kind of a change. I don't know why.
But you find that he's mellowed quite a lot. He's quite different to when he raced.
Yeah, and I think it's just so funny. Like, they did he came on Greg's show, and they talked, and the co-host had said something about them being rivals and competitors, and he says, no, we're friends. And Greg's like, well, kind of competitive friends. No, we're friends. And I thought, whoa, that's a change. That's a real change. But super affectionate, super, super friendly. I'm surprised by it.
Okay, so that's it for today. That was Kathy Lamond we heard from there. A reminder, you find us on Twitter, at @cycling_podcast, on Facebook, and our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.